You're listening to Turning Hard Times into Good Times with your host, Jay Taylor. If you have a question or comment about today's show, Jay would love to hear from you at 1-866-472-5790. That's 1-866-472-5790. You can also send an email to questionsfortaylor@gmail.com. That's questions, the number 4, taylor@gmail.com. Now, back to our program.
Welcome back to Turning Hard Times and Good Times. I am your host, Jay Taylor, and I'm here with Alistair McLeod, and we're surely hoping that Alistair can help us turn hard times into good times, not good times into hard times. So thanks for joining me again, Alistair.
That's my pleasure, Jay.
I always enjoy having you, even when things aren't so rosy. We do have a lot of things to be concerned about, certainly in many different areas, as we were talking before we went live. But I'd like to focus today primarily on gold and the upcoming recession and how gold might perform in a recession. We can certainly look at how it's done in past ones recently and then try to determine how this time might be different. I don't know. We'll hear what you have to say about that. Whenever you start your articles, you always have a sort of an executive summary at the start that lets the reader know what's coming and what the major points are. And you started out the one on July 21st that's titled Gold and the Upcoming Recession. You started out by saying, and I quote, "We are now seeing the initial stages of a currency, credit, and banking crisis develop." And as you've said many times in previous discussions on this show, we no longer really have business cycles. We have what is really a credit cycle. And recessions and depressions are caused by the contraction of credit. But in your article, this one, the July 21st article I referred to, you said you began by pointing out the sanctions of Russia are as a major contributor to this downturn. So if recessions are caused by credit contractions, can you explain how sanctioning Russia is contributing to this particular one?
Yes, certainly. I think the easiest way to understand it is to put yourself in the shoes of a director of a bank, and let's say a reasonably big bank. Let's say you're even Jamie Dimon, who you may recall at the beginning of last month upgraded his forecast of the economy from stormy to hurricane.
Right.
And I know we've spoken about this before, I think on your show. Mm-hmm. What he was actually saying is that he is seeing lending risk, counterparty risk, increasing very substantially. He sees a downturn in the economy. He sees interest rates rising. When you put all these things together, as a banker, if you have got a highly leveraged balance sheet, which at this stage of the credit cycle most banks have, I would hasten to say that the American banks are less leveraged than banks elsewhere. They're less leveraged than the UK, less leveraged than the Eurozone, less leveraged than Japan. Similar, perhaps, to China. Mm-hmm. Now, this is very important because if you are highly leveraged as a director of a bank and you start getting bad debts or non-performing loans, as they call them, or alternatively, if you see that the bonds you might have on your balance sheet are beginning to lose value as the yields rise because of the interest rate situation, mm-hmm. then the losses that you incur are magnified like 20 times for the shareholders. Mm-hmm. This is just on the balance sheet. And it's America, I think if you look at JP Morgan, they're around about 9 or 10 times. So it's not quite as bad as 20 times, which is the situation in the Eurozone. And it's a situation in Japan. For all the major global systemically important banks in those two jurisdictions, they are incredibly highly leveraged. And I think the common factor behind it has been negative interest rates. Anyway, mm-hmm. the point is that if you're a director of a bank, you see the economic outlook turning, what do you do? You stop lending. And what you do is you call in loans where you can. you tell SMEs, you know, the small and medium-sized enterprises, you know, we're not going to renew your overdraft facility when it comes up for review in next month, for example. So this is contraction of bank credit. Now, nobody in the system, I mean, by the system, I mean, in the establishment, in government, in the Treasury, or indeed in the Fed, seems to understand this point. And that is that, you know, if you look at GDP, all it is, it's the sum total of credit transactions, transactions done through bank credit. Okay, there may be a little bit of, you know, banknotes transactions, but it's very minor, believe you me. It's probably no more than a 20th or a 30th of the total. You know, what is this GDP? It is the sum total of transactions in bank credit. Now, the assumption, if you read all the analytical stuff that's coming out of Wall Street brokers, you know, they're talking about a downturn in the economy because the consumer is not spending or there is not supply or, you know, whatever. That's actually not the point. The point is that the banks are taking the rug out from underneath the economy because they are frightened about the consequences of being overleveraged into a falling economy. So what you're going to see with bank credit, with GDP, is contracting bank credit, taking GDP down. That is the importance of this point in the credit cycle. And that was really the point I was making in that article.
Right. And of course, quantitative tightening just started just recently. I think we've gone to the full, is it $90 billion in the U.S., $90 billion the Fed is taking back now after an extraordinary amount of juice that's been added to the system, starting with the epidemic.
Yes, of course, and you know, they're doing this in that sense too late. What they're likely to do is once they begin to see GDP contracting, in other words, bank credit really contracting and affecting GDP, they're likely to stop quantitative tightening and reintroduce quantitative easing. Because the only way in which they can keep GDP up is to replace bank credit with their own version of money. And that basically is QE, which bolsters, guess what, bank credit. But what it does is it does it in a specific way. It gives funds to insurance companies and pension funds to spend in their portfolios. And that money leaks out into the general economy. And also by hopefully supporting financial assets in the more general sense means that confidence in the economic outlook is retained by the normal sort of, if you like, actors in Main Street. That is the idea behind trying to keep markets up rather than letting them fall. It's all about engendering confidence in the population about the economic outlook. Because if you see falling share prices, you think, well, obviously, things ain't so good. So, you know, if they're holding up in the face of bad news, well, perhaps things aren't so bad after all. That's the level of thinking we have in the central bank, I'm afraid.
Wow, that's pretty incredible. Even though it's all artificial, essentially, it's money created out of nothing that props up prices. And, of course, in the process, Alistair, there's this reallocation of wealth from the system, from the society, to those that already have money. They can make a lot more money in this casino. In your article, you also noted or you made the statement that you suggested that the best thing the Fed should do, or what it should really do, is do what the Fed did back in 1920, 21. It was a newly created institution then. I guess it hadn't learned new tricks too much then. But what it did was it really cut to the chase and took credit away early on, right? It didn't allow things to get out of hand so much.
Yes, I mean, basically what it did was it stood back along with the government. Long experience had taught the government in particular, and as you say, the Fed was a new institution at that time, but the governments of the day knew that the last thing they should do is intervene in a process where you've got a slump in the economy. And sure enough, the recession that you're talking about, or the slump, it was very deep, but it only lasted about 18 months, and that was from 1921 to 1922. Compare that with Hoover intervening, followed by Roosevelt intervening. And I mean, they just basically made the whole of the 1930s, you know, a complete depression. So that is the difference between government non-intervention and government intervention, so starkly shown in two succeeding slumps.
And was it Lord Keynes primarily responsible for this evolution of thinking, the idea that an interventionist government, an interventionist central bank, that is, stimulating the demand side of the economy was the solution? So let's just have government spend to pick up the demand when the private sector, when it isn't there in the private sector.
Yes, he was the leading, one of the leading economists at the time saying this. But there were others like Irving Fisher and so on, who all sort of took similar attitudes. But I think Keynes is probably most known as recommending government stimulus. In other words, when the economy weakens or goes into recession, the slack has to be taken up by government spending to stimulate the economy out of its recession. And to be fair to Keynes, in those days, even though this was a fallacy, but in those days, he basically said that over the business cycle, then the government could recover its financial position through increased tax revenue. Mm-hmm. And the interesting thing is that you've got a lot of people who claim to be free marketeers now talking about, the best thing to do is to cut taxes, run a deficit, and then, we'll pick it up on growth later. So, these mistakes are still being made.
Those are the supply-siders in the Republican Party, essentially, the monetarists,
Yes. Yeah. Essentially, yes.
And they don't understand the need to have honest money. They don't understand the danger and the damage it's caused. Of course, a lot of those folks are also very strong pro-military, pro-aggressive military action on the part of the American Empire. They believe that we should constantly be going, and making other countries good, like us, I guess. Anyway.
Well, yes, I think, I mean, that's a slightly a different topic or angle on the whole thing. But I mean, there is no doubt that American hegemony is being very successfully challenged now. I mean, the latest thing over this oil is actually fascinating, because NATO's policies, led by America, have been to try and isolate Russia and also China. And what has happened is that Russia has managed to corral all the oil producers in Asia, including, it now appears, the Persian Gulf and Saudi Arabia, into working with a combination of China, Russia, the Shanghai Cooperation Organization, join the BRICS. You know, all this sort of stuff is going on. And if you look at it from the Saudis' point of view, I mean, you know, we're telling the Saudis, we're telling everybody that fossil fuels are evil, and, you know, we've got to cut it all out, and we're all going on electricity somehow or other, whenever. Where is the future for these guys? Well, the future is Asia. It's not with us. So really, you know, our policies, anti-fossil fuel policies, are just, they are a very, very big part of the shift in hegemony away from America into a new Asian super state and those that are all part of it. It's a fascinating time to watch that development, and what a mistake for us to make. I mean, the other thing I would say is that while we're paying through the nose for high prices of oil due to our own fault, I mean, there's nobody else that's responsible for it. What's happening is that Russia and Saudi and all the rest of it are quite happy to offer discounted oil prices at current levels to members of their club, you know. So we're paying through the nose, and these nations are getting it on the cheap, and it's very good economically for them. So, you know, whichever way you look at it, I mean, we've made the most appalling errors over energy policy. It's just unreal. has just handed everything on a plate to Russia. And, you know, nobody seems to know it. Nobody seems to understand it, which I find really, you know, pretty depressing.
Yeah, it is. And I just don't, it's hard to understand, except I know we don't hear about it in the media. We don't hear that message in the media. We only hear about, you know, this, the notion that we can bring Russia to its knees by, with, but it isn't working very well with these, you know, with our current policies, for sure. What do you think is driving American policy? It seems to me that it has so much to do with the military. I just see, you know, all of it, there's, you know, every now and then there's another $300, $400, $500 billion for weapons that's sent to that's sent to the Ukraine, and who's producing these weapons?
Well, American armaments businesses, basically.
Yeah, exactly.
You know, that's the answer. I mean, it's good business for the boys. And, you know, that I'm afraid you're right. It's driving U.S. foreign policy. I mean, you know, look at it from the Europeans' point of view. You know, they're being driven into the ground. Germany's got a real problem because it's got no energy. I mean, the gas has been cut off, supposedly because the paperwork with this generator, which was being fixed in Canada and shipped back, and, you know, it's not there yet, and they've got to do the testing. So, you know, basically, this is giving Russia the excuse to just sort of sit on its gas and starve Germany into submission. I mean, you've got to bear in mind, what actually is Russia trying to do? It just wants to get America out of Europe. Mm-hmm. And right. It's the Europeans who are being squeezed, you know, as a result of that policy.
What will it take for the Europeans to, I mean, why are they so locked in?
Well, that's
a top-down issue from the leaders, the elites that are locked in with the goodies that they get by being part of NATO and part of the system.
Yeah, I think it's, I can't talk about the goodies, but basically it's, you know, it's a hangover from the war. I mean, bear in mind that America basically set up the European Union in the very early days. It also set up NATO, and, you know, it's the establishment, and an outfit like Brussels is essentially so establishment, it can't see anything else. So it'll follow its establishment situation to the death. And that's basically what it's been doing. It's been killing the German economy completely. And this winter is going to be a real horror show through lack of energy. I mean, you Americans know all about a continental climate in the winter. I mean, one thing you want.
Yes, we do.
Keep warm and have food. And it's rapidly moving towards a situation where neither is going to be there. And you've got you know, in Italy, you've got real problems. In the Netherlands, the farmers are striking and, you know, throwing eau dure at government ministers. And this is just the start of it. I mean, we haven't hit the winter yet. So this is not going to be nice in Europe, I can assure you.
Okay, so the Keynesians and what, you know, clearly what the Fed is trying to do now is to bring prices down by curtailing demand. But it seems to me, if you just forget about the supply side of the supply and demand aspect of pricing, then you're just addressing one half of the equation. It's not going to work, is it?
No, it's not going to work. And you're actually not addressing the right thing at all, because the thing that really determines prices is human action. If I can steal that term from Ludwig von Mises for his great work.
Sure.
You know, it's not government ministers who decide what the price is, say, for a barrel of oil or, say, for a Chrysler motor car. No, it's the consumer. And one thing that the consumer looks at is what his buck actually buys. And if he thinks that his buck is going to buy less tomorrow than it does today, what does he do? He gets rid of his bucks and he, you know, by buying things which he doesn't actually need ahead of time. So what you have is you have got a manufacturing slump. And at the same time, you have got people just trying to get rid of deposits. You know, their deposits. And the other side of that, of course, is that the banks are trying to reduce their balance sheets at the same time. So, you know, the purchasing power of money in the hands of the consumer basically sinks towards zero. This is why, you know, a fiat currency basically loses its value at the end of the day. When all that trust in the value of the currency goes, it becomes worthless. And after all, I mean, what we're doing is we're doing on a global scale what John Law did in 1720. And when his Mississippi bubble collapsed, and today the equivalent is the bond bubble and the equity bubble, the bubble in financial assets, derivatives, the whole thing. When that collapses, what happens is it takes the currencies down with it. That's going to happen again. I can't see any other outcome.
So no matter what happens, I think your view has been that we're going to see higher interest rates. We have to see higher interest rates. And of course, there's some academics that are suggesting that that's not possible when you have such a high debt to GDP level. But I think what they're ignoring and what they're not taking into account, at least, is the potential for the currency itself to become worth less. And of course, we as Americans look at the dollar now as strong relative to your pound, to the euro, to the yen. And we say, oh, we got a strong dollar. But in terms of its purchasing power, if you're losing 9% a year, it's not such a strong currency, I guess. But we seem to be missing what it seems to me Americans are missing is the notion that somehow we have this strong economy. We're a really strong, financially strong nation. And, you know, you pointed out already on this show that Russia has something like a 17% flat tax compared to our high tax rates. They have a debt to GDP of something like 30 compared to 130 for us. You know, they're exporting, they're a net exporter. They're not getting hurt at all by these sanctions, it seems. China, unlike us, have huge amounts of foreign credit, and both of those countries are building up gold reserves like mad. And yet, our people seem to think we can continue to print money, even though there's not too many foreigners wanting to buy treasuries. I guess they do when rates go up and we have the highest rate ever, you know, among the developed countries. So I guess at that time, then there's foreign buyers of credit, of treasuries. But why are we Americans not seeing the big picture here in terms of the geopolitical picture in terms of economics?
Well, I don't suppose it's any comfort to you, but you're not alone in this. This is not seen throughout the West at all. This is something that's evolving. And what happens is that eventually you end up with a crisis. And we know what's going to happen. I mean, we've seen it so many times before. When the banks start contracting their credit, banks go bust. Well, they need to be rescued. And then suddenly everybody wakes up and thinks, oh, my God, this is a terrible situation. I didn't think it was like this at all. And, you know, I'm going to lose my job or whatever, whatever, whatever. And suddenly, you know, everybody wakes up to the reality of the situation. And also, to be fair to the general public, they are being less misled by the central banks. I mean, we have something called the Monetary Policy Committee, which sets interest rates. You have the FOMC. Yeah. I don't know if you ever bother to read the minutes, but they never mention money. You know, come on. You know, so they don't know what they're doing, or if they do know what they're doing, they're not telling us. I mean, how can you expect the public to know, you know, to make a rational judgment over the situation? I think that's actually quite unfair to expect them to do so. And of course, all this is just misleading the public. I mean, the idea that you've got to keep confidence going. What's that? That's misleading the public, isn't it? So. Yeah. The whole situation is one of keeping the public in the dark. So, and this one, I wouldn't so much blame the public. I mean, why should the public be interested in what's going on in the economy? All they're interested in is their little bit of life. You know, they work for someone or they got a little business or whatever it is. What they're interested in is preserving that and improving on it. They're not interested in the big picture and all the rest of it. They take that for granted, and they should be able to take it for granted, but they're not permitted to take it for granted by the actions of governments and central banks.
Mm-hmm. So we have a gold price that has not responded to this inflation so far, to any great extent anyway. I guess maybe in other currencies more than the dollar. It's probably up. It's probably doing a lot better relative to the pound sterling than it is the dollar right now. But we have a lot of games that are being played in the paper markets. And as you've pointed out in your article, now it seems as though this whole notion of the Gold Antitrust Action Committee folks talking about manipulation of the gold markets. It's not so much conspiracy or tinfoil hat theory anymore. We've seen some pretty established people coming out and admitting it. And in fact, of course, there have been some spoofing charges against some J.P. Morgan traders and the like. And so it's pretty hard to say that the gold markets aren't being manipulated these days, isn't it? Now,
well, you're absolutely right. I mean, we had Peter Hambro pointing out that the Bank of International Settlements has run a secret campaign with the major central banks to suppress the price of gold. I mean, we've known about this, but the thing that's different is that we have someone who is actually at the center of this as a professional, mm-hmm. Now admitting that this is the case. So, yeah, I mean, that's right. Now, I understand totally the inflationary implications of monetary policy, but I felt that this would end in a crisis rather than, let us say, a 1923 German-style hyperinflation. It's not like that at all. Mm-hmm. I think what we're going to have is we're going to have a crisis, and then the expansion of central bank credit to support the whole system is just going to go through the roof. And remember, they've also got to support the government, whose borrowings, as you rightly pointed out, 135-140% or something in America.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
I mean, it's worse in some states in Europe. I mean, under your delightful President Biden, he may be asleep at the wheel or the switch or whatever, I think you'll find, I mean, you're rapidly going to move towards 150-175-200% debt to GDP. And when you take out the government element of GDP, that, if you like, means that debt ratio is even higher,
mm-hmm.
yeah. which arguably you should do because, what supports government debt? Well, it's government tax revenue. You don't count it twice. You need to take government spending out of the GDP number in order to make a proper assessment of that debt to GDP figure. But nobody does it, of course. Nobody does it.
No. Well, you don't want to. Yeah, you want to keep deceiving people. I guess that's the key. Keep people down on the mushroom farm, as they say.
Well, yes, it's a bit of that. It's also, for those in the system, it's keep deceiving yourself. I think that is a part of it.
We've talked in the past about Basel III and the regulations against the incentives, at least, to discourage derivatives in the precious metals. And yet the article and the information that I saw involved, I guess it was Peter Hambro, or at least people were speculating that Peter Hambro was probably noticing this skyrocketing increase in derivatives in the precious metals markets. Q2 of this year just absolutely exploded to the upside. Could you talk about that and what that may be pretending?
Yeah, it hasn't actually suddenly appeared. It's just a reclassification of gold from foreign exchange.
Uh-huh.
And this is under the Basel III rules. So it's Basel III that's done that. But what it has exposed is the extent to which the Treasury's two principal actors in this, which are obviously J.P. Morgan, like big time, and also Citicorp or Citibank, or whatever they call themselves nowadays, mm-hmm. Are the main players in these derivatives. And certainly, I mean, you're looking at J.P. Morgan, whose dealers are now up on criminal charges. I think if it was Goldman Sachs, they'd be claiming they were doing God's work. But
yes.
So, well, I mean, the whole sham is beginning to fall apart, Jay. Mm-hmm. I mean, I think that's one way to look at it.
Mm-hmm. Well, I guess it just depends on who you think God is. If you think it's our current chairman of the Fed, or if it's Mr. Biden, I guess maybe you're doing his work. Let's see. So Jamie Dimon, I liked a tweet you put out just the other day. You say, despite manipulating precious metals prices, J.P. Morgan is still at the heart of the LBMA, SBMA, and COMEX. So there he is, Jamie Dimon, smiling and
Yeah.
And doing God's work, I guess, as you say.
Yep. Or what passes for God's work, I think.
I have to ask you, it seems to me that, you know, with China and Russia, you know, again, China has these excess foreign reserves. While we have been digging ourselves into the ground that is running these huge deficits and other countries buying our treasuries, China has had net exports, and they've had, you know, built trillions upon trillions of dollars worth of foreign reserves, and they're building their gold reserves and so on and so forth. Gold is always, in the history, I believe, has always moved from, has always moved to where the wealth is. And clearly, wealth is being generated in Asia right now, in China and other countries, but China primarily. It seems to me that we are in a position now where they're exerting more and more control over us, and our corporations are so dependent now on Chinese markets making money. The NBA couldn't criticize the takeover of Hong Kong. And now I notice here that, in fact, the United States is required, if products are made in Taiwan, they have to be labeled made in China and so forth. And if the United States doesn't comply with that, they're in trouble with the trade with China. So it seems to me that we've dug ourselves into a political hole, in a financial hole, in a political hole, in which we are, you know, in a position of being subservient and very quickly losing our position as a hegemon. With a minute left, maybe you comment on that.
I think that's right. I mean, it's part of, I'm afraid, the decline of the West. I mean, it's not just America, it's us as well, compared with Asia. I mean, you know, you've got basically Asia is completely self-sufficient, and it's also managed to rope in, you know, South American countries and sub-Saharan African countries. Mm-hmm. And of course, with the oil thing, they've got the whole of North Africa and the Middle East as well. I mean, you know, we are now, America, Europe, and Britain are a small minority in this world. The idea that we control the rest of it, I'm afraid, is actually rather falling apart. And we have to kowtow to them, you know, like Apple. I mean, as you were saying, Apple has now got to put made in China on.
Exactly. Exactly.
Made in, you know, it's just. But,
exactly.
I mean, I can understand the pressures on them.
All right, we'll have to leave it go at that. Alistair, you know, we're looking in the rearview mirror now, you and I. We're old guys, and we're looking at the past, and we have to somehow prepare for this future. It's a brave new world, as they say, and we better be pretty brave the way it looks. Well, thank you so much for being with us, and we'll look to do it again, I hope, sometime in the not-too-distant future. Folks, that is it for this week. Next week, Doug Casey, Michael Oliver, Michael Spreadborough of Noble Resources, my guest. Until then, goodbye, and God's blessings to you, and I don't mean the guy in the White House. Bye for now.
Thank you again for listening to Turning Hard Times into Good Times with Jay Taylor. Please join us again next Tuesday at noon Pacific Time, 3 p.m. Eastern Time on the Voice America Business Channel.